Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm in basic, I've just entered Fort Dix. I'm telling somebody who's actually a regular soldier that I'm going to go to be trained as a medic, but I didn't think I'd be going to Vietnam. And he says to me, "What do you think they need medics? On the Jersey Turnpike?"
When Gary Kulik was a young man, he was drafted for the war in Vietnam. He thought of himself as a conscientious objector. Yet after giving it some serious thought, he went to Vietnam as a medic. How he got to that decision, what he saw in Vietnam, and how he thinks about the war today as it lives on in cultural memory are the topics of this conversation. As is the Catholic doctrine of just war and the conditions under which going to war is considered right in the eyes of our church. Gary and I talked mostly about Vietnam, but also about the other wars of recent memory, World War II, Afghanistan, Iraq, and of course the current war in Ukraine, on Almost Good Catholics. Welcome to Almost Good Catholics, a conversation about theology and apologetics, about religion and history and culture. I'm your host, Chris Odinius, and I get to ask interesting people who have thought about the big questions to share their conclusions, to explain what we know, how we know it, why we think we know it. I hope this format and relationship and dialogue and back and forth may help us approach the truth and to have a really good time doing it. Should you want to take the conversation a step further, I invite you to please email almostgoodcatholics@gmail.com. Gary Kulik, a Roman Catholic conscientious objector, served in Vietnam as an infantry medic for 5 months in 1970 with the 4th Infantry Division and completed his tour as a clerk in the headquarters of the 61st Medical Battalion, Dustoff, which is the call sign for the medical evacuation air ambulance helicopters. He returned from Vietnam to complete a PhD in American Civilization at Brown University, later serving in management positions at the Smithsonian Institution and at the Winter Tour Museum, Garden, and Library. A former editor of American Quarterly, he is the author of War Stories, False Atrocity Tales, Swift Boaters, and Winter Soldiers, What Really Happened in Vietnam. So welcome, Gary, and thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Your story is extraordinary, Gary, because you were opposed to the war in Vietnam and opposed to fighting in this flawed cause, and yet you went to serve and put yourself in harm's way to serve your country. Would you like to tell us about how you came to that conclusion?
I did not come easily to it. I grew up in a family with close ties to the military. My father had served in the Marines prior to World War II, and then served in the Army Air Corps as an officer during the war. His two brothers graduated from, one from West Point, one from Annapolis, and they had long and distinguished careers. The three of us, actually, my two uncles and myself, overlapped in Vietnam. That was a defining part of my life. And had Vietnam not happened, I could conceivably have had a career as an officer. I grew up in a family of officers. When it became clear that I was going to be drafted, I had to make a choice, and the choices were existential. I wasn't going to Canada. I wasn't going to jail, but I could not, or rather, and I could not serve as an officer in a war I didn't believe in. I was a Roman Catholic in Massachusetts. The likelihood that I could have prevailed as an alternative service conscientious objector was remote. And here I think it's important to distinguish. Lots of people don't know this. But during the time of Vietnam and going all the way back really to World War I, it was possible to take two routes to conscientious objection. One was to claim that a deep religious belief precluded any service in the military. And the second was to claim that I was prepared, you were prepared to serve in a non-combatant role. Mm-hmm. Non-combatant came to be defined as the medical corps early in World War II. So those were the options faced by young men in the 60s certainly in the 60s.
So to say, when you say alternate services, mm-hmm. that would have been something outside of the military entirely.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. And for people who grew up in the so-called peace churches, Brethren, Quakers, that was an easy claim to make. Mm-hmm. For those of us who grew up in churches that did not embrace pacifism, that was a harder claim to make,
yeah.
but not impossible. The core of liturgical churches in the 60s, although they didn't require you to be a pacifist, embraced the idea that you could be individually, that your conscience precluded killing.
Yeah.
So that was the claim I made to my draft board.
Is there any context in which you, for example, you wrote in your book, I knew that they might ask me, would I have gone to World War II?
Yes.
What would you have said had they said, okay, let's go fight the Nazis?
Well, I knew in my heart that I would have. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I was a beneficiary of a kind of Catholic education that allowed me to say this to myself anyway, that the question was hypothetical and anachronistic.
Right.
And I could not answer it with moral certainty.
Right.
I was not self-schooled, but well-educated in Thomist philosophy in my college years at St. Michael's in Vermont. And so this was an easy argument for me to make. I could not answer the question with moral certainty.
So it's 1968. And you are in college, is that correct?
I was I graduated from college in 1967.
67. Okay, so you're just out of college.
Just out of college, and I had grown to be invested in both the moral grandeur of the early years of the civil rights movement and mm-hmm. and the possibility of helping people escape poverty. Those were all.
You went to Elizabeth City in North Carolina.
This was under the auspices of my college and the Catholic Order, the Order of St. Edmund.
Okay.
They had a mission in Elizabeth City, and this was my opportunity. This was the opportunity that came to me through my college, and mm-hmm. These were promising young students. Mm-hmm. many of whom went on to college. Some were the daughters of faculty at Elizabeth City State College at the time. So these are urban kids with a reasonably good chance of success. So this was a kind of an enrichment program, not a remedial program.
Gotcha.
And I did that for two summers. And then after graduating, I decided to join what was then the Domestic Peace Corps, VISTA. And so I served for a year in Nashville, Tennessee, as a, quite frankly, a failed community organizer. well, it just wasn't in my personality to do that, and I wasn't very good at it. And I was deferred as a result of that. And then I had applied to graduate school in American Studies at several places after graduating in 67, but I deferred it to do the year in VISTA. The draft law changed for those of us who graduated from college in 1967. Had I graduated a year earlier, it would have been possible to continue a graduate education with student deferments year after year after year, which is what Dick Cheney did, and basically age out of the draft. But this modest reform in 1967, after 1967, made it clear that this wasn't going to happen. When I went to Providence to my first year at Brown, I knew that I would only be allowed to complete 1 year. I didn't know at the time that these 2 years of deferment were absolutely critical to my escaping the worst killing years in Vietnam. Those years were 67, 8, and 9. So I knew that I was going to be drafted. I made my case to the draft board in the fall of 1968. I made it as a Roman Catholic conscientious objector. My understanding at that point was that I would count in whatever quota that draft board had. So it was an easy decision for them. I'm willing to serve.
Right.
They didn't agree. They might not have agreed with why. Or my stance on conscientious objection, but that didn't matter to their numbers.
Yeah.
So it's pretty straightforward. So I knew that I was going in by the summer of 69, which is what happened. I want to go back. I grew up in a Catholic household. My dad's grandparents had came from Poland. My mother's had come from Ireland, both sets of grandparents coming to the country in the early 20th century. My mother was probably more insistent than my father, but we did the standard things. We went to church every Sunday. We observed the holy days of obligation, but we did nothing beyond that. We didn't do novenas. We didn't do First Fridays. None of the things. I wasn't an altar boy. I didn't go to Catholic school until high school. And I sometimes think that that saved me from, I suppose now, stereotypical vision of what Catholic education was like in the 1950s and early 1960s. So I came into Catholic education. I spent 8 years, high school and college, among nuns and priests. And in many ways, that was absolutely formative. My formative years in high school were really late. And in many ways, the most important teacher I ever had was a nun, Sister Marie de Lourdes. I'd gotten into her class by accident. I was supposed to have taken American history prior to that. I hadn't, but it was overlooked. This was a seminar. She sat in the middle. We sat around her. There were 10 or 12 of us in this seminar. It was a government. It was a give and take. This wasn't traditional rote learning. This was what do you think about this? and you could disagree. This is 1962, 1963. We never sat down to read anything called Catholic social teaching.
This is a high school history class?
This is a high school government class.
A high school U.S. government class with 10 or 12 kids.
10 or 12 kids.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
This is a huge high school.
Yeah.
And I'm in this class by mistake, and it was the most important class I ever took. This Sister Marita Lourdes was a committed New Deal Democrat. She loved Franklin Roosevelt. She had great hopes for JFK, but the nuns were wise to him. They knew that he was a problem. And I remember one nun saying, "Well, we hope Jackie can keep him straight." The readings we did, which were on the early years, obviously, of the American Constitution, but led into the civil rights movement, issues of discrimination. The first serious book review she asked me to do was a review of Milovan Djilas, the Yugoslavian dissident, the book called The New Class. Now, this, if you were a Catholic liberal in the 1960s, you were also deeply anti-communist. In the good sense, not in the McCarthy sense. We knew what they were doing to priests in Poland and Hungary, and what they were doing to the church.
Yeah.
So that was my inheritance, and of course it happens at the same time. This class sort of opens up for me all sort of possibilities that I hadn't thought of before, including going deeper into. At the time, I was thinking. Sociology was a really exciting field. There were popular books out there. Absorbing this, not knowing that this is Catholic social teaching, in the midst of the beginnings of the civil rights movement, the anti-poverty movement, that's the driving force.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are the connections I was able to make as I came to articulating a position before my draft board on Vietnam.
Well, I certainly see why you're invested in education and the, all the programs to fight poverty. And did you just see that the war in Vietnam would be a inscrutable, tangled mess that nobody knew what was happening anyway? Or because I could also say, like, well, aren't you fighting, the totalitarian oppression of peasants on the other side of the world, or you saw the South Vietnamese government as inherently corrupt, not democratic at all. How did you sort this out?
Right. I don't think I had a coherent political position on what was going on in Vietnam. I'm quite sure I didn't. I thought the war was wrong. For all the reasons that young left liberals thought it was wrong. I'm sure that I bought some, not all, but some of the anti-war rhetoric that, and of course, some of that rhetoric was directed at the corruption of the South Vietnamese government. But it was also, an incredible romanticism about the North and Ho Chi Minh, and what about that business? Didn't he quote the Declaration of Independence when he took over the country in 1945? I mean, I bought into that.
He had been at the Treaty of Versailles, right? Talking to Woodrow Wilson.
I didn't know that then. That's right. Rebuffed by Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah.
No, so I, that was in the air. And again, the war seemed to me wrong.
Is this because we are sick and tired of Western Empire, and who cares about the communists? Maybe they'll be okay.
I think my anti-communism was weakening at that point, and would probably weaken a bit further as I was in graduate school. But that's another story. To me, the war was morally wrong. The other piece of the Ho Chi Minh myth was that he was much more a nationalist than he was a communist. He's the driving force to expel the French, and here we are replacing the French. So I think all of that added up to a series of moral sentimentality about Ho and the North, and
yeah, Yeah.
So that's as we would have said in the 60s, that's where my head was.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But then you have to put this to make an argument to the draft board. And as you observe, they're pretty hard-nosed, the Irish Catholics themselves.
Right, right. But again, I'm willing to serve.
Yeah, exactly. So and that would be fine for them, right?
Yeah. They might not have, I'm sure they didn't agree with me. But I'm going in.
And did people think you were crazy? Were other people your age who were against the war saying, what are you doing? Why are you being part of this? What were your friends doing?
Well, one of my friends came to my draft board hearing with me, and he came out of a similar Catholic social teaching background, even though we weren't studying Catholic social teaching as per se, but that was the surround in which we were living at the time, and it's a good question, and I think it may simply have been, my sense that this was a decision I had to make, and only I could make it. I wasn't at all very attentive to what other people were doing. I saw myself as having to make a fundamentally different decision.
Mm-hmm.
That would be personally authentic. The 60s was a time when the expectation was that you would act with authenticity. And there were things, therefore, that I couldn't do or felt I couldn't do. I could have easily gotten into the National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
But that seemed to me wrong. I was spindly in build, tall, but spindly. There were people who starved themselves, went to great lengths to make sure that they were below the weight limit for their height.
Mm-hmm.
There were other people like our former president who got medical deferments for questionable illnesses or ailments.
This is Mr. Trump.
Yes.
Because we also, we know that George Bush went to the National Guard. Dick Cheney, like you said, went to graduate school.
Right.
Joe Biden, I think he was in law school, maybe.
Well, he's married. Yeah.
There is a very, except for John McCain, except for the Senator Kerry and the other Senator Kerry, Bob Kerry of Nebraska, I think.
Mm-hmm.
There's
mm-hmm.
not that many famous Vietnam vets in public leadership today.
Well, Al Gore, sir.
Al Gore did. Okay.
Yeah. Right. I mean, there were countless ways to game the draft, avoid it.
Especially for somebody with means and connections.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But all that felt false to me.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it.
Do you have a feeling that you were mortally afraid or that the chances were pretty low? Or you were like, I'm willing to roll the dice to keep my honor and integrity?
I was naive.
You were naive, yeah. You're feeling immortal.
Well, I don't know that I felt immortal. I there was a piece of me that thought, well, why would they send me to Vietnam? And of course, mm-hmm. that was the naivety. And I remember queuing for orders somewhere. I'm in basic, I've just entered Fort Dix. I'm telling somebody who's actually a regular soldier that I'm going to go to be trained as a medic, but I didn't think I'd be going to Vietnam. And he says to me, what do you think they need medics? On the Jersey Turnpike?
Yeah.
So it gradually dawns on me that that's likely where I'm going.
So you're at Fort Dix, New Jersey. Then you go to San Antonio in Texas.
That's right.
And you liked your drill instructors. You thought they were tough but fair.
I did. I came to like them. I mean, I hated basic training.
Yeah.
The loss of freedom, the, just the sequestration in the barracks with, no privacy.
Yeah.
It was hard on me. It was very hard. And at a certain moment, I called my parents.
Mm-hmm.
We had connections. And so I'm doing everything I can So I'm writing to the chief of military history. I'm looking around for anything that would allow me to avoid Vietnam. And I was successful. Mm-hmm. So my first assignment after medical training was to the historical unit of the Surgeon General's office at Walter Reed. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm the only enlisted man, the only enlisted historian in an office of young officers and some more senior people. And I was assigned projects. But this didn't keep me from what would eventually happen. I would end up in something the military calls a levy for the spring of 1974 for Vietnam.
Uh-huh. I was under the impression that that was because you were writing articles for left-leaning newspapers, but not so. That would have happened.
I was doing foolish things that I shouldn't have been doing.
Yeah.
But when I requested my military records a few years back, there was a clear letter from the executive officer of the historical unit asking that I be relieved from the levy. Mm-hmm. So it went directly to the commanding general of Walter Reed. It was endorsed by him. And it went to Army personnel, and the word came back denied, that the need for medics in Vietnam was overwhelming. So people who might have known or perhaps knew that I had written pieces for the what was then the GI Underground Press overlooked it,
right? Because there's a war on.
No, they overlooked it in the first instance because, you know, for whatever reason, they wanted to keep me there.
Yeah,
and it gets overruled by bureaucrats who probably know nothing. My immediate superiors knew or had to know. I had been under investigation in basic training because of radical literature that I had, and that I had authored pieces in the GI Press, but they overlooked that.
Got it. That's yes, I understand. Yes,
which raises the question. I mean, my political protector was in Washington at the time, but I think I decided I wasn't going to go back to him. I wasn't going to ask a second time. You know, I think it was embarrassed and ashamed that I had used political influence to avoid the war. So I went. Mm-hmm. I was prepared to go. And again, this delay, this, you know, the historical unit duty lasted about half a year. So in addition to the year of graduate school, in addition to the year in Vista, I'm arriving in Vietnam when units are going home. Mm-hmm. There's no more. The 4th Infantry had gone into Cambodia. It had pulled back by the time I joined it. I didn't know it at the time. It was on its way home.
Got it.
6 months later, or 5 months later, it was gone. There's another piece of this that I've written about. Once assigned to a battalion in Vietnam, I never left the headquarters company.
This is the 4th Infantry Division, is that right?
4th Infantry, 4th Medical Battalion.
4th Medical Battalion.
Yeah. And the reason for that is that I was a college graduate. I was 24 years old. I was a college graduate. I had a year of graduate school. I did well on standardized tests of the sort that the Army also gives you. Mm-hmm. And by any measure, you know, my file comes into the battalion personnel office and I'm, you know, they want me. And, you know, the headquarters company was that's where the safety was. That's where the promotions came. That's where the R&R billets first came. So a medic with lower test scores, not a college graduate, would have run greater risks than I did.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And you had, a medic is sort of a first responding kind of, like, who might be in an ambulance today. You haven't had much medical training beyond what you got at San Antonio and New
That's
Jersey.
Right.
But you know how to stop blood. You know how to
give shots. Right. Right.
Tourniquet.
That's an interesting story. We were cautioned about tourniquets. This wasn't just we're fighting the last war. We're fighting the last war 100 years ago.
Hmm.
I only recently learned there's been a study of this, and I'll look it up, but I don't have it at my fingertips right now. We lost men because of the fear of putting tourniquets on.
Yeah.
We were cautioned to be very careful about it. You know, the study that I recently saw was basically an argument that no one with truncal and bleeding should have died.
Mm-hmm.
No one. That's what tourniquets are for. I'm sorry, not truncal bleeding, but bleeding from the arms or legs.
Yeah.
So we were cautioned on that. But, you know, I wasn't a field medic. I worked in an aid station.
Is this in Pleiku in the Central Highlands of Vietnam?
In An Khe.
An Khe, okay.
An Khe in the Central Highlands, right. So I'm in a very large compound. You know,
do you feel like you could get killed any moment or not really? You're removed from the front.
We went out outside the wire to accompany patrols, day and a half perimeter patrols. I was so assigned once.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, the risks are rocket attacks or you know, attempts to breach the perimeter, and those were real. But no, I'm not in the field every day with a maneuvering infantry platoon. And again, that was the virtue of coming both to the war late and coming to the war with my personal background. Mm-hmm. When the fourth goes home, I was reassigned, and once again, you know, I end up in this battalion headquarters, and I answered honestly the question, "Can I type?" And that was the end. That was, yeah. You know, I'm going to now serve my time as a clerk, which is, you know, a cushy job.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, there's a funny story attached to that, you know, the outgoing battalion commander wanted the perfectly typed 7 pages. This is when you had to do carbon copies. You know, it had to be perfectly typed, no strike overs. And my predecessor hadn't been able to finish that. So this is my job,
yeah.
Basically. I remember complaining to the executive officers, who was a, you know, lovely guy. Can't be right. You know, I'm trained as a medic. I want to fly. I want to be assigned to a dust off unit. And he kept his word, but only after I finished the 7 pages perfectly typed for the outgoing commander. And you know, bottom line is that I failed the eye test. I wore glasses. I didn't have 20/20 vision. You had to have 20/20 vision in order to be in flight crew.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't get a chance to play John Wayne or whatever.
Yeah.
It was a disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I'm safe.
And not only are you safe, but you also haven't got any blood on your hands, which is what I think.
That's right.
There's no danger of making a mistake when you're, I mean, there's a danger of treating a wound poorly, that kind of thing. But there's no danger of like shooting before you're sure and that sort of thing, which I think is always a risk. I mean, that's a risk when you're driving the car and you're looking at your cell phone, but it's definitely a risk when you have a rifle and are in a foreign land that you don't really understand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or any place with high confusion, lots of noise, that sort of thing.
I'm writing a book now on conscientious objector medics, and it's pulled together from a variety of sources, including oral interviews. There were some COs who took weapons, and I have no judgment against them, no way to judge that. One fellow I interviewed sort of rationalized it as a patient protector. A guy I served with who was a CO, was on ambush patrol one night and took a 45 from the platoon sergeant. So as protection. So
Do you have a sense of when it's appropriate to fight, when it's not appropriate to fight, in absolute terms? I mean, clearly you had a strong moral feeling, and clearly you were right. I think you sleep with a clear conscience of just from reading your first book. That it's you seem like a man who lives well with the decisions he's made, and I think many people, you know, I've been very lucky. I've never been in a difficult position like that when I was the right age for the war, and we had a war after 9/11. I was already signed up for the Peace Corps, and to my thinking as a 20-year-old, I'm going to go serve in the Peace Corps in Muslim West Africa, I felt like I'm doing my part. And it's true that it's a very comfortable part. There's no danger. 10 years later, where I was got overrun by villains from Libya, but nobody would have predicted that when I was there. And it was a very safe, very comfortable kind of thing. And I felt, and I sleep. But I always, you know, I wonder, did I miss out on the job of my generation, which was to go fight this thing. But you managed to not bloody your hands and put yourself on the front lines, which I think is a double honor. And I think every war has this confusion. And you look at all the 300,000 Russians who are escaping from Russia into Uzbekistan and places like that, because they know the last thing they want to do is go shoot at Ukrainians, that sort of thing.
Yes, yes.
And we have, you know, Pope Francis saying that the defense of Ukraine is a clearly just and moral war. And we know that one's so easy to see from the outside. And maybe it's much more confusing when you get to the front lines, and it's much more confusing because humans are messy. And we would like to think that World War II is very clear. But I think Vietnam, and I think perhaps Iraq, are very, very confusing. Do you have guidelines that you live by that you have learned as you study this and interview people? What are the conditions for a just war or that sort of thing from the Catholic point of view?
Well, actually, I think the Pope came slowly to the notion that this was a just war. He didn't speak out very clearly initially.
That's true.
And seemed to blame NATO and Ukraine to some extent for the situation. Let me go back to maybe this is both. This is a somewhat of an answer. I don't. I was never a true pacifist. In extremis, I would have picked up a weapon and defended myself. And when I think about what the Ukrainians are doing, I mean, I just stand in awe.
Mm-hmm.
And I fully support arming them to the hilt, both arming from the U.S. and arming from the EU. I note with some pride that it's the moral center of Europe has shifted east.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
the Germans and the French are still dilatory, but it's the Baltic countries, it's Poland, especially the tiny, the three.
Estonia.
Just so strong for Ukraine.
Yeah.
I was technically a pacifist for 10 months.
Yeah.
And was never really tested. Never really tested.
Yeah. Well, I see here in the Catechism of the Catholic Church in paragraph 2309, it says the strict conditions for the legitimate defense by military force require rigorous consideration. The gravity of such a decision makes it subject to rigorous conditions of moral legitimacy. At one at the same time, they must, and here's four bullet points. The first one says the damage inflicted by the aggressor on the nation or community of nations must be lasting, grave, and certain. It says all other means of putting an end to it must have been shown to be impractical or ineffective. The third one is there must be serious prospects of success. And then the use of arms must not produce evils and disorders graver than the evil to be eliminated. The power of modern means of destruction weighs very heavily in evaluating this condition. So those last two, I think, are problematic for Vietnam. One, is hard to know how you're ever going to win. And two, there was a lot of collateral destruction.
Well, yeah. But I think the last point really speaks to proportionality.
Yeah.
That you respond only to the point where you have to.
Yeah.
And don't go further. And of course, Vietnam was marred by war crimes that we committed, that the North committed, that the Koreans committed, which violate principles of proportionality.
Yeah. But you also make a point that in your book, and you give many examples of this, that we as an American society, and especially sort of the public Hollywood, public intellectual face of us, have painted Vietnam as an unmitigated disaster full of war crimes, which far exceeds the reality. And you cite sources that say, three quarters of the veterans are proud of their service. Two thirds would have done it again, even knowing the outcome. That, the war crimes are real and not to be ignored, but they're also very rare. And yet we've painted with a broad brush.
No, I think that's right. And this, of course, is now, part of my mature thinking about the war. No, I think the war was framed very early by left liberal anti-war thought. And, the notion that it was atrocity producing by its very nature was a substantial part of that framing. I don't think anyone in all honesty can say that we've uncovered every war crime that Americans committed. But, now years and years after, no one has been able to come up with anything remotely like what happened at My Lai. And yet there are still people who think that was typical of the way we fought the war. It wasn't typical. It was utterly atypical. Mm-hmm. And I'm pleased that Marshall Poe has a book coming out on this that I was a reader on. And there's a blurb by me on that will be on the back of his book.
What is it going to be? What is it called?
I'm not sure what the title is, but he's thoroughly investigated the testimony. He's really the first to actually sit down with the reams of testimony that came out of My Lai to come to a certain set of conclusions. And I won't. I'll let him. But it's a powerful book, and it certainly makes the argument that this. This was exceptional and not standard. I think for me, the book I wrote, which came out in 2009 and was in the works quite a few years earlier, was in some part the result of what happened in 1989, the collapse of communism across the East, and then of course the collapse in 1991 in Russia. This was a way for me to rethink all those anti-communist simplicities about Vietnam and the simplicities of the anti-war movement. There's long been a trope on the left that fascism had to be destroyed, but communism could be reformed. Well, 1989 gave the lie to that. It wasn't being reformed. It was overthrown by incredibly brave people in Poland, Prague, and elsewhere.
Yeah, well, and so any system that has no dissent or no vehicle for this debate will become right. brittle. And
indeed, yeah. I don't know how it could have happened, but I wish the South had prevailed. I wish we had stayed in support longer. Vietnam right now is run by homegrown Stalinists. And you look at what's happened in places like Korea and Taiwan, which are now, you know, reasonable democracies. They weren't initially. They, you know, they too were run by right-wing
yeah.
authoritarians.
Military cabals. Or
yeah, hotels. Yeah, it's changed. What are the difference that would make? So that you know, led me to want to read far more than I had read in 1969 about mm-hmm. why we were in Vietnam and what it meant. So I find greatest resource there are historians who write not about the American war from the American side, but historians who know the language, who write about the history of Vietnam in those during that period. That's where all the interesting work is being done now.
Yeah. No, and there's a problem just... maybe it was a time when there were not that many people in America who were Vietnamese, that there were not enough GIs who understood the language, the customs. You know, if you go fight in World War II, if you go fight in France or Germany, there's plenty of American soldiers who are French or German. Or like you and I are Polish, we could go to Ukraine and it would make perfect sense. But if mm-hmm. there were not enough actual immigrants of Vietnamese extraction, then you really are a total foreigner. And I wonder, did you have a feeling that was it bewildering to be and not to be able to tell who's who or what's what or what a friend looks like or a foe looks like if they're under the thinnest disguise, or am I projecting my own ignorance of the culture?
I think there's no question that young men went to Vietnam with no knowledge of the Vietnamese. I think what was even more disastrous is that our political leadership and our military did the same thing. Yeah. So, you know, but yeah, the 18-year-olds, you know, some of them treated the Vietnamese badly. And
I'm sure they were afraid. And hostile.
Well, I don't even know if it was fear, but just, you know, contempt for a difference. Mm-hmm. You know, Vietnam was not a particularly sanitary place. Vietnamese women chewing betel nut, which turns your teeth blackish red, were, you know, objects of scorn for many young GIs. Again, I can't, you know, I was older. There was an occasion when I was treating a Vietnamese man who'd was a laborer at the 4th Division's base camp, and he had a head wound from something hit him. And I don't say this amidst the pride, but I treated him the same way I treated any American who needed to be stitched up. Mm-hmm. I think about that now. I mean, we were never trained to do anything like that. And, you know, in the United States, you can't, you know, nurses can't do that. But we're, you know, I learned to suture just by watching other medics. But I think, you know, that may have been an exception. I think. I never felt fearful. I'm encountering these people in most cases in a controlled environment. I did go on what were called the med camps, where we'd go out. I can't even remember what camp now stands for, but we would bring medical aid out into the villages and line up, and we would do whatever, give them aspirin or It's pretty primitive. It wasn't anything special. So I was in that environment. But I think sometimes it's important to remember only some American soldiers were in situations where they couldn't be sure of who was friend and who was foe.
So this is a Hollywood trope I'm repeating to you.
Well, I think it's somehow it all depended on where you served. If you served with the Marines up close to the DMZ, your enemy was the uniformed army of the North Vietnamese. There weren't any peasants out there. The same thing if you served deep in the Central Highlands, you're fighting against a uniformed army. If you're serving in the coastal areas where My Lai was, then you're in an environment where you're not sure who the enemy is, who the friend is. So that needs to be, and not surprisingly, the atrocities happen, the American atrocities happen in those areas where you can't distinguish easily friend from foe. And there was also a whole other program that both the Marines and the Army came up with of, I forget the terminology, but this was small units embedded in a village, in a coastal village. Marines did this, Army did this. And I know people who had that experience. And they're the ones who have high praise for the Vietnamese and for their army. They served with them. And it's usually people, soldiers who didn't serve with anybody, many Vietnamese soldiers who have contempt. And these were situations where, at the very least, you're not going to have a My Lai level atrocity because you know these people. You're serving next to them.
Yeah.
Now, there was some coercion involved in this as well. I mean, you're also keeping young men from joining the Viet Cong.
Yeah.
But that was a minor part of the war. Westmoreland wasn't interested in investing much in that. And so he elected to fight a big battalion war in the countryside where, again, the difficulty of separating friend from foe was much more acute.
Yeah, there was a, and I can't remember where I heard this, but there was a discussion I listened to about David Petraeus and what he called the Petraeus Doctrine. And his whole idea was, I want you guys to pull over in the Humvee and get out of the car and go have tea with the people. And mm-hmm. the local commanders didn't want to do it because it put their soldiers, the Marines, in harm's way. And they literally called it breaking the seal. And it's like, if you break the seal, as if you were on another planet and you're taking off your helmet, you know, that breaking the seal of the, like a cordon sanitaire sort of idea. And I thought, if you never get to sit down and eat food and drink tea with these people, you are never going to understand. It seemed like such a sad state of affairs when like that was an unacceptable risk, just to like that's not a war that can be won if you don't ever figure out who of course, how are you going to prevent somebody from joining the Viet Cong if they don't think Americans are people too, right?
Yeah. But those were tactics never developed on a large scale. Yeah. And you know, I have no argument that somehow things could have been different if they had been. But yeah. I know that there would have been fewer war crimes.
Yeah, no, that's I understand exactly what you're saying. Well, we have been talking for an hour. We've barely scratched the surface of this book, which is really about the culture of how we interpret the Vietnam War, looking back, and especially from in the 70s and 80s. And I don't know if you want to say that, or we could leave that for the readers to pick up the book. I found it really easy to read, extremely interesting, and just a series of very provocative and very relevant essays.
If any of your listeners want to read a book that's not the conventional book on the Vietnam War, then I would strongly recommend my book, War Stories, which I think was an even-handed effort to assail some of the myths of the war from both the left and the right. You know, if your mind is open to thinking differently about the war, and I think for many people it's not. You know, it's many people my age, I should say. I mean, it's a new world for younger people who may not have been as engaged in it. You know, there's some terrific work being done by historians of Vietnam who know French, know Vietnamese, and in most cases are too young to have been much affected by the 60s and anti-war rhetoric that developed then. And the last thing I'll say is that, you know, I'm working on another book, and this is on conscientious objector medics. The Forgotten Medics of Vietnam is the tentative title. And I hope to have a proposal out to publishers relatively soon. I've had the proposal vetted, and the book is basically finished. I need a publisher, so looking forward to getting that done.
Yeah, well, congratulations on both. The first book is called War Stories, False Atrocity Tales, Swift Boaters and Winter Soldiers, What Really Happened in Vietnam. It is a rigorous, attentive, nuanced, and very thoughtful look at many of the stories we have been hearing, and sometimes take credulously, and especially for those of us old enough to remember John Kerry's run in 2004, both his champions and his detractors. You look at them both. And the forthcoming book is probably going to be called Forgotten Medics of Vietnam. And so we can look forward to that.
Right.
Thank you, Gary Kulik, for being part of Almost Good Catholics. Right.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris.
Nails, spear shall pierce him through the cross. Be born for me, for you, and hail. Hail the Word made flesh, the Son of Mary.
Chris Odinets and Gary Kulik recorded this conversation on Monday, February 13th, 2023. It was the feast day of the Vietnamese saint, Than Phao Lo Le Van Lao. He was a priest in the Apostolic Vicariate of West Cochin China in Vietnam, and he was murdered in the persecutions of Emperor Thu Duc in 1830. The Catholic tradition perseveres in Vietnam even today under a communist regime. Our music is from Josh and Margot of the Great Space Coaster Band, and their website is www.gscoasterband.com. And our logo comes from a stained glass window at the Monastery of Santo Domingo de Silos in Spain, and from the Dominican Friars of England, Scotland, and Wales at www.english.op.org. I'm Chris Odinets. Thanks so much for listening. I look forward to talking to you next time.
This is Christ the King, whom shepherds guard and angels sing.